Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Gail Dines, Professor of Sociology and Chair of American Studies at Wheelock College in Boston. She's the author of multiple books and articles and has been described as the world's leading expert on the effects of pornography. She's the author of the highly acclaimed Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. Translated into four languages, Pornland is the basis of a documentary released this fall by Media Education Foundation. Dr. Dines is founding president of Stop Porn Culture, a nonprofit organization composed of academics, professionals, and activists from a wide range of perspectives that's dedicated to raising public awareness about the impact of pornography on children, youth, and adults. So first, thank you so much, A, for your work, and B, for being on this show.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Derek.
So I guess the first question is so the last sentence or last phrase of your bio is dedicated to raising public awareness about the impact of pornography on children, youth, and adults. That leads to the question of A, what is that impact? Or B, what's wrong with porn?
Well, it's interesting because when people ask me that, they're often thinking of porn 15 years ago, which is basically Playboy or Penthouse, which as sexist as it was, which was basically, you know, a woman with no clothes on smiling in a cornfield. As sexist as that was, those are the good old days. Today, pornography has shifted rapidly, and it shifted because of the internet. The internet domesticated porn, and by doing so, it made it affordable, accessible, and anonymous. The three things that have driven demand. Now, as demand was sort of became greater and more men were using more and more porn, a kind of boredom set in. And in order for the porn industry to meet the needs of the users, they had to keep increasing the level of violence. So today, and I never really thought I would say this, the old days of Playboy and Penthouse and even Hustler are the good old days. What's wrong with porn, if you want to know, is put porn into Google and just follow the breadcrumbs of a 15-year-old boy who's got no money. And what you will be catapulted into is a world of sexual cruelty, of misogyny, of debasement, of dehumanization. That's mainstream porn today. If you want to find so-called soft porn, you're going to have to look for at least 20 minutes to half an hour. And you tell me what 15-year-old boy with an erection is going to be searching for 15 minutes for non-hardcore porn. So the problem with porn is that mainstream porn today is now the kind of porn that I would say a generation and a half ago you would have to go to a porn store and the back of a porn store to find that. That kind of violent porn is now front and center and virtually the only porn made by the porn industry.
So I want to talk about the violent porn in a moment, but the thing you were saying about the woman standing in a cornfield is, in my book, Culture Make Believe, I wrote a chapter about, called Seeing Things, which is about pornography. And to do that, I had to do research because I'd never actually looked at much or any porn in my life. Except for the entire culture being pornographed. I'd leave that aside for a second. And I couldn't look at the really horrible stuff. And I still found, and basically all I looked at was probably a month or 2 months of looking at pictures of naked women standing in a field of daisies or something. Mm. And what I found objectionable about even that, I mean, of course there's what the effects on women, but what I found for myself is that, you know, there's the cliche of what men do is undress women when they see them on the street. Mm-hmm. And that was entirely foreign to me. That is just something that had never occurred to me. If I might see a woman I might be interested in some way, I might fantasize about having a conversation with her or something. what I found, one day I was walking to the library and this woman passes me the other direction after I'd been looking at porn for like 6 or 8 weeks. And I suddenly wondered what color her pubic hair was. And this had never in my life occurred to me before. And in that moment, I still remember where I was on a sidewalk. In that moment, I thought, this has affected something as intimate as my spontaneous fantasy life. And that's actually when I quit doing the research. And I was like, I can't do this anymore.
Well, you wouldn't have that question anymore because no women have any pubic hair in porn, so that wouldn't even come to your head. The question would be much more, I would say the average guy today after spending 6 to 8 weeks looking at porn would thinking, I wonder what that cunt looks like with my dick down her mouth as she's gagging. Those would be the questions. The idea of asking what her pubic hair colour is laughable. That's the degree to which this has shifted. I mean, pubic hair has gone, as it has in the real world of young women, and now the daisy field has been replaced by women being gagged with a penis, which is the constant image you'll see when you put porn into Google. The other image you'll see is really rough pounding anal sex, and anal sex is used in porn as a way to deliver to women the message of the woman just what a real filthy, dirty, slut, bitch, whore she is. And that's the ultimate message of porn. Whatever story it tells, that's what it boils down to. That women are filthy, dirty sluts, and whatever you do to them, not only do they enjoy, but they actually seek out and they deserve.
And so what do you say to the people who say that this sort of advertising has no effect, that it's all fantasy and that there is no real world effect of this? I mean, I can keep separate, you know, what I see there from what's reality. You know, I watch a cowboy movie. It doesn't mean I'm going to go ride a horse.
Okay. I've got a great answer to that. What I would say is let's talk more in terms of political economy now and think about this. We all accept that the fashion industry impacts the way we dress. We all accept that the way the food industry, you know, shapes the way we eat. How could it be possible that the porn industry would be the only industry in the world that had no impact on the culture? I mean, the question I want to know is how would that be possible? We know that in a capitalist society's industry-shaped culture, they're not just profit-driven entities, they're also cultural shapers. And to argue that pornography had no effect on the way that people think about sex, sexuality, relationships, and intimacy would basically to say that images have no impact, that in fact you're born a sexual being and it's divorced from the culture and that it is a stable reality who you are sexually. We know that's ridiculous. We know that we are evolving cultural beings. And so I would throw back to people and say, explain to me in a society where we know that industries shape the world, explain to me how in a society where we have a multi-billion dollar a year called industry, called advertising, that uses images to change behavior, how then does pornography stand outside of all of those industries? You see, it's a nonsensical question to say how it shapes reality or not. Of course it does.
And I think that a lot of indigenous peoples would argue that the cowboys and Indians movies certainly shaped culture too.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's the whole point of making a World War II movie where you're killing the krauts or something.
Well, let's even go back to Birth of a Nation. Okay. One of the first feature films that was over 2 hours long, and Birth of a Nation was crucial in basically whipping up white racism.
Oh, wait.
Oh, don't tell me it's gone off.
No, it's still going. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt. Sorry about that.
Okay. When you think about, say, Birth of a Nation, what was very interesting was prior to the Birth of a Nation being shown in a cinema, you would have the Ku Klux Klan having a huge parade beforehand. Birth of a Nation, as was indeed the minstrel shows, were major forms of whipping up white racism against African Americans. We know for a fact that one showing of Birth of a Nation would not have made you a Ku Klux Klan member. But put Birth of a Nation in a racist culture where racism is the hegemonic way of thinking, and then Birth of a Nation, of course, not just doesn't so much change the way you think as it cements the hegemony floating around. That's the same as porn. People always say, how does porn change views? I wouldn't ask that question. What I would say is, how does porn cement the misogyny that circulates through our culture and include pop culture? And what porn does, unlike any other form of imagery, is it delivers to the man messages of misogyny to his brain via the penis in a crisp, succinct way that is unambiguous and unquestionable. That is why pornography is so important an issue for feminists. Nothing quite delivers to men the message of pornography in the way that pornography does.
So let's talk about finances for a second. And you are a part of a huge organization that is taking on all these tiny little pornographers.
I wish.
Don't you think it's unfair to pick on them with all your strength?
Oh, yeah, all of my millions in the bank, yes. I mean, yeah, let's talk finances, because this is one of my... Listen, let's just say that you can't get a PhD in an English university in sociology and not come out with a Marxist perspective, okay? And that was my reality. So I always follow the money. That's where the most interesting things are for me. Now, the porn industry, if you put porn into Google, you come up with millions and millions of, you know, hits and sites, and you just get kind of lost by the images. But let's get some reality here. Basically, the porn industry is run by really one corporation. It used to be called Manwin, M-A-N-W-I-N, as in Manwin, Women Losers. It is based in Luxembourg, and the head of it was a man called Fabian Thiemann, who was a 30-odd-year-old German businessman who revolutionized the porn industry. And what Manwin did is it systematically bought up distribution sites. Now it's called MindGeek. They've kicked out Fabian Thiemann because he was arrested for tax evasion, so they got rid of him very quickly. Now, when you go into Google and you put porn into Google, you will come up on the front page with the free porn sites. And there's about 5, 6, 7 of them. I would say that MindGeek, I think it owns virtually all of those free porn sites. Now, your portal into the porn world is indeed the free porn sites. It's very difficult to get into the porn world without going through the free porn sites. So now let's talk about the fact that one company that is in Luxembourg that has offices all over the world, including, by the way, Los Angeles, controls most of the distribution. So really what you have is the Nike model of porn. You've got production, which is diffuse all over the world. You've got production in Los Angeles. You've got production in Nevada. You've got production in Eastern Europe, where you have no end of women in poverty. But it's the same as making Nike. Women make Nike sneakers all over the world. They don't make any money. Who makes money off Nike sneakers? Nike, who brands them at the end of the distribution chain. That's the same as porn. Porn now does the Nike model. Mass diffuse production, concentrated distribution. And at that distribution, which is where the money is, that is where MindGeek sits. So you are looking at now a multi-billion dollar a year industry. Now, this has enormous ramifications, because it's one thing to have an industry that has lots of small players. When you have an industry that has a major player, think of the political and cultural power of that money. And if I may give you an example of this, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation a few years ago put forward Measure B, which was basically to say, very reasonably, that anyone in LA making porn should have to wear condoms in order to prevent STD outbreaks, HIV outbreaks. And then there was this massive fight against Measure B. And I discussed it with the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, who actually, very brave organization, and they actually got Measure B passed. And then when we started looking at all these organizations that came in to fight Measure B, some of them were like the Republican Women's Association of America. I thought, this doesn't make sense. So I started phoning all these organizations that evidently were fighting condom use. And guess what? It was the same disconnected number at the same address. Who do you think had set up all these dummy corporations? MindGeek, which, by the way, you know it's illegal to use foreign money to bring into the United States. So now they're under investigation by the Department of Justice for trying to affect laws in the US. So it's, you know, that's called AstroTurf organizing. That's what that kind of money does. So all these so-called arguments against the Measure B condom use, a lot of the money was financed by MindGeek.
I don't, I hear what you're saying, and I don't want for readers to get the, or listeners to get the impression that if somehow someone were able to sue MindGeek and cause them to go into bankruptcy, that the entire porn industry would topple.
Well, what are you going to sue them on?
The point is that it's centralized does not imply that addressing that single target would address porn in any way.
It does activists is it finds the weak link. You see, it does make our life easier because if we have to go after tons and tons of industries in the supply chain, then we're really busy like chickens with our head cut off. But as an activist, I'm always thinking, what is the weak link in the supply chain? And when you've got so much power concentrated in one place, it's a very good way for activists to think about, you know, the...
Right. I'm sorry. I wasn't really clear. What I was trying to say is that that doesn't, I mean, there are a lot of other fingers in the pie, are there not? Like
yes.
Viacom, like hotel chains. So it's not, I just wanted to make clear that it's not just one company getting fabulously wealthy off all the porn in the world.
Well, hotel chains are no longer. You know why? Because hotel chains only run softcore porn and men don't want softcore porn. Men bring their hardcore porn on their laptops to their hotels. So the, basically the hotel porn industry is going down because no one wants what you can get on the hotel porn. So that's gone. But I mean, you have to think about the way in which MindGeek is stitched into other global corporations. I mean, think about, for example, imagine every time a guy puts a credit card in to buy porn, think about how many corporations are involved in that feeding chain. Just think about it. Banks, credit card companies, venture capitalists. Do you even know that the porn industry is so sophisticated that they have a thing called cascading payment systems? And what this is a guy, remember, the guy's hot and bothered. He wants to get off as quick as possible. And then he puts his money into a paid website because most of the free porn sites direct you to paid websites pretty quickly. Now, the thing that's going to kill his erection is if it comes back saying credit card rejected, okay? So what you have now is this another industry which does cascade payment systems. So if he puts his card in and it gets rejected, there's all these organizations that come in and say, accept his card because we will find somewhere along the line somewhere that will pay that fee. So that's how sophisticated it is. So, I mean, you are talking about one of the most sophisticated industries. And let me say how sophisticated it is as well. One of the largest porn conventions every year is January, right now more or less, actually, in Las Vegas. And every year, that porn convention, which is often sponsored by Adult Video News, on one floor of the huge stadium, wherever they have it, is the porn convention. And on the next floor is the biggest electronics convention of the year. And people go upstairs and downstairs because the electronics and the porn industry work hand in glove.
So can we talk about the actual, like, what percentage of commercial internet use? I've heard, I don't know if this is true, I think this is, that that porn is the largest single commercial use of the internet. Is that?
They say about a third of the internet is porn. I mean, it's very hard to pin down exactly, but from lots of different stats I've seen, it's about a third of all internet use is somehow linked to porn.
And pornography has driven at least some of the development of the technology, has it not?
I would say virtually most of it. For example, pop-ups, payment systems, there's a whole list of things it's driven. And also the other thing it really drove was the mobile phone. Now, let me say why this is. Think about this. Like every industry, you want to maximize profit. And so how do men get their porn via the internet? Traditionally, they got it through a laptop or, you know, a regular computer. If you live in a place that is overcrowded like Brazil or India, the guy cannot be jerking off to porn in the middle of the sitting room, which is where the family live. Why they put so much money into the mobile phones is it allowed them to get to Brazil and to India so that the guys had a portable way of basically using porn. And then I want you to think what it means to go to a place like India, where in many cases they've never seen a naked woman. right? And then all of a sudden, overnight with the mobile phone explosion, they get access to the most violent porn imaginable. And this is what's happened. And in London a few years ago, at the XBiz convention, which is one of another porn convention, a lot of the workshops were on developing the mobile phone screen because they said we can't get into Brazil and India without developing the screens on the mobile phone.
So, I know we've talked about this, but I'm really bring home the effects of seeing these images. I mean, I tried to do this in a very small way by saying that it affected my spontaneous fantasy life. And it took me probably 3 or 4 months of not watching porn after that to recalibrate. And
how old were you, by the way, when you did that?
Oh, that was about 2000, so I was about 40.
Goodness me. At 40 years old.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the average age of first viewing porn today is 12. Now, think about this. Think about 12 years old is when you're developing your sexual template. You probably had no sexual experience, and you put porn into Google, and you think you're going to see breasts or maybe people having sex. And you are catapulted into a world of absolute and utter violence and cruelty. Think of the impact on the 12-year-old boy. Now, I have a son who's older than 12, and I think about what it would have meant for him at 12 to put porn into Google and to come up with a woman with her semen smeared all over her face to the point she can't open her eyes, exhausted, crying, gagging, vomiting. Can you imagine the trauma of a 12-year-old boy when that is his introduction into pornography? And I think this explains why so many boys at such an early age become habitual users. If you know anything about sort of trauma literature, that often when you're traumatized, you go back to the point at which you were traumatized to try and hope that you can play it out differently. And that's why I think so much habituation is going on with young boys today. I think pornography is traumatizing an entire generation of our young boys. I mean, I'm a radical feminist. People expect radical feminists to be man-haters. That's the image that they have had of us. Let me tell you, we are fighting not just for our daughters, but for our boys as well. Because I am arguing that not only are girls and women being, you know, victimized and traumatized by the porn industry, but I think a whole generation of boys are being victimized and traumatized. That young boy at 12 who thought he was going to see a picture of maybe a naked woman and then sees the gagging and the violent anal sex, think what exists in his stomach. Think of that toxic stew of anxiety and shame and arousal and fear, and then think of how that is shaping his sexuality. And the thing that we know is the younger you habitually use anything, the more difficult it is to recalibrate after that. So you at 40, walking around thinking, what color is that woman's pubic hair? It's laughable, but it makes you want to cry when you think of the 12-year-old and what he's being catapulted into.
And what, in your perspective, are the effects on women and their sexuality?
Well, there are studies now coming out on this as well. And what they're finding is that a lot of women, well, first of all, let's make it clear. The pornography industry always want to say that women are using porn all the time. That's actually not strictly true. Porn, whenever I interview the pornographers, they say to me they wish more women were using pornography, but the truth is it's still mainly men. And the main pornography, which is the violent porn, is men alone after their wives or girlfriends have either left or gone to bed. So the effects on women is actually quite similar. Very toxic mix, shame, a fear about they can't live up to the images in actual pornography. And also what I have found, now this is anecdotal, but I want to say something very important, that you hear enough anecdotes and it coheres into data. And that's a big issue in feminism, that we listen to what women have to say. And I travel across not just the country, but much of the world. And I, many of the women who are using gonzo porn are actually victims of sexual abuse. And I've had women tell me that because of their rapes, they cannot orgasm unless they're watching a woman being degraded and humiliated. So why women use porn and the effects on women is very complicated and is tied up with the enormous amount of sexual violence against women and girls.
And I think something that's really, really important to remember always is that part of the point of any system of oppression is to attempt to get the oppressed to participate, quote, willingly, end quote, in their own oppression.
A la Gramsci, and I hate to quote Althusser because, you know, he killed his wife, but Louis Althusser also argued that. But let's take Gramsci because he didn't kill his wife, so we're on safer ground with Gramsci. I think that was the brilliance of Gramsci, is that Marx often thought about ideology in kind of a blunt instrument. And what Gramsci came in and did was to really, I think, make it more nuanced. And he said, look, you cannot impose an ideology from above if those who you're imposing it upon do not get something out of it. And so, like you said, you have to get the oppressed to somehow think that their interests are tied in with the interests of the oppressor. Otherwise, it's not going to work. And this has worked beautifully with women. Women have been told that in order to be noticed, or as I like to say, fuckable, you might have to bleep that out. In order to be fuckable, you have to conform to a porn image, because if you don't, you're invisible. And really, if you put up fuckability versus invisibility, who wants to be invisible in this world? And especially if you're talking about adolescence, where the actual DNA of adolescence is to be visible, is to be seen. And in our porn culture, if you do not conform to the pornified images of women, then you will not be seen and you will be invisible. That's the problem that women face today. And what makes me crazy is when you get this third wave feminism saying that looking hypersexualized is actually a choice based on wanting to empower oneself. Real choices mean you have lots and lots of choices on offer, and you pick one depending on your background, who you are, your creativity, your authenticity, all of those things. Today, when young girls are wandering through the culture, wondering what does it mean to be female, there is only one image on offer. The Miley Cyrus, Beyonce, hypersexualized, fuckable image that says, if you want to be noticed, this is what you have to look like. There is nothing empowering in conforming to the images of the oppressor.
So of all my books, I think one of my favorite lines I ever wrote is that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like economics or philosophy or religion or just the way things are. And so it seems to me that this oppression is normalized, and this hatred of women is also, that's one of the ways that the hatred of women is normalized, is not only, of course, through pornography, but also through the mainstream objectification of women through media and the media portrayals of women. Actually, that's something I want to bring up. Did you ever know the work of, the guy who did all the, George Gerbner?
Yes, of course. I knew George Gerbner well, yes. I actually knew him personally.
I interviewed him maybe 1998 or something. One of my favorite interviews I ever did. And one of the things, if you recall, was, Casting and Fate, where he talked about, the important thing with, say, violence in film is not that there's an act of violence, but the question of who does what to whom.
Exactly.
And he was talking about that's how, if you record, like, Bruce Willis can be a white male who is a policeman, and he can kill 15 people in the first 5 minutes of a film, and nobody cares. But if you have a woman who is not a police person, who then kills someone, the whole movie has to be about why she would do something so horrible. And so that ties back to porn here on who is doing what to whom.
And also, I think Gerbner, who is, unfortunately, I think a lot of postmodern media studies has wiped Gerbner off the face of the earth, and that young people are not studying Gerbner in media studies. And his stuff was so important, because what he showed, as you said, was who's doing what to whom. But he also showed that the more you watch television, the more you have a television view of the world when you hold all other variables constant. And so what was amazing about Gerbner's work, and which is what I use in my book and I discussed before, is his question isn't just how does media change reality, it's how does it cement it in a way that allows those in power to continue to oppress the powerless. So Gerbner on many levels was actually a revolutionary. I think some of his work was wonderful. He also talked about, I think he really put his finger on it when he said, why are films so violent? And he said, one of the reasons is because now you have a global market. The language of violence is international. I mean, let's think about it. Take a British movie that I just saw, which is Pride, which is excellent, which is looking at the relationship of how the lesbian and gay community in England joined with the miners to fight Thatcher. There's a lot of dialogue in there. It's very difficult to export it to other countries, but you take a violent movie and everybody understands a bullet and blood and guts. And so that's really had a big impact on the movie industries. The fact is there's virtually no movie you can make now that doesn't make tons and tons of money. If it completely bombs in the United States, you just drop it off in some other country. And I actually remember when I was traveling a few years ago in Israel and I was looking around what you saw in different parts, especially when you went over to some of the territories, was a lot of the movies that you'd had in the movie houses for maybe 2 days here and then were gone, were all over, and they were making a fortune.
You know, my writing mentor, when I was learning how to write, had a piece of serious literature that explored questions of – it was great. It was like at the intersection of thriller and literature where he had – there was some action – but at the same time, there were explorations of the effects of this act of the violence on the people involved. And he sold that to they sold the rights to that, and it ended up becoming a big action film in Japan with all of the actually exploration of the violence taken out, and there was nothing of violence left.
I could have told you that was going to happen. There's another similar story, actually, that there was somebody doing some really good media literacy work in Maine, and he went into a classroom and he gave kids cameras and he said, you know, you can make a 3-minute tape. What do you want to do? And they had to write the film and then act it. And of course, all the boys were doing violence and shooting and killing. And he said, you know, that's absolutely okay. You can do that. He says, but remember, if you're going to do that, you have to write in a funeral. And then you have to write in people crying because people are dying. So you can't just have the violence. You have to then have well, let me tell you, that changed what they thought they were going to do. And I thought that was a brilliant idea, is to get them to understand the consequences of violence. And I really think if you sort of want to bring it back to porn, you know, I do travel and I speak to young men, college age students everywhere. And to say in their favor, I don't think they really get the lives of the women that they perpetrate this violence against. I don't think they even see it as violence. I think they don't understand that when they ejaculate on their faces without asking them, or flip them over and do rough anal sex, they don't see it as violence. And they come up to me afterwards, and this can be in a hall of 500 students at a university, and they'll come up to me afterwards and they'll say, oh my God, this is what I've been doing. This is who I've been. And that's a good sign, because they've been so brainwashed by the porn culture. And all it took was an hour's lecture on my part for them to begin to get some of their humanity back. And so in a lot of ways, I do have some hope. And now there are the sociopaths who are gone. You realize we're never going to get them back. But I don't believe that's the majority of men. I think if we carry on down this road, we're going to have a lost generation who we are not going to be able to bring back to humanity. And I would hate for that, especially as a mother of a son. I would hate for that.
You know, this reminds me of something an environmental mentor, John Osborne of mine, always says about how you have to repeat a lie 1,000 times because lies are just very expensive, and we know the truth and our bodies know the truth. And this is one reason why the timber industry has to say again and again that deforestation isn't harmful or something.
Yeah.
And it's the same with this, that it has to be repeated. But, you know, and this also reminds me of, I've said this before publicly, that when I was a teenager, it was very common to use the word fag, and it was just a generic insult that actually meant nothing. And I stopped using that word after I was teaching a friend of mine how to drive, and he ran my car into a telephone or into a pole. And I said, "Oh, you fag." And he was bisexual, and he looked at me and said, "Yeah, I'm a fag. What does that have to do with me running your car into a pole?" And yeah. I had never made the connection between this abstract word that meant nothing to me and the actual slur. And all it took, really, was him pointing out that this is a real insult for me to start to have to start to change.
Well, I think that's a great example, but I want to sort of take it one step up and say, look, the timber system and all, you know, the timber industry and all the other, you know, sort of earth killers, what they don't have on their side is what porn has on their side. And what porn has on their side is they connect their message to arousal and ejaculation. Think how powerful that is. So the timber industry and lots of industries has to keep saying it over and over again. I think given the biological reality of porn, that the message is encoded into the body via arousal and ejaculation, I think you have to say it a lot less, actually. And that's what scares me.
So to be clear, what you're saying is that men who look at porn and masturbate to it are getting the biological reward of an orgasm, which is a very, very powerful biological reward for performing, for watching this act of degradation, and that cements the connection between degradation and pleasure in a very somatic way.
Absolutely. That's excellently put. And I would add to that, it also cements their relationship with porn. Because if you look at when you have an orgasm, you release all sorts of hormones that actually sort of really help you bond with the person you're having an orgasm with. And when I often see men who are ready literally to kill me because I'm anti-porn, what is going on here? And what I realize is they have bonded with their porn in a way that we would hope you would bond with the person you're having an orgasm with, you know, to build a somewhat intimate relationship. And so there's that profound bonding goes on as well. So yes, what you said is correct, and add that to the fact that they've got a sort of bonding going on with their porn.
Well, that was another moment, and I wrote about this in Culture Make Believe. That was another moment in my understanding of porn, is that at one point I'm sitting there in front of the computer, and it suddenly hits me that no matter how much I might want to fantasize that I'm hanging out with this woman whom I love, the truth is I'm sitting in a hard-backed, hard-cushioned chair, you know, sweats around my ankles, looking at a computer screen, listening to UFO play Rock Bottom in the background. And it's like, that's kind of pathetic.
It's sad, it's lonely, and it kills intimacy.
And in addition, I mean, if somebody... Neither one of us is against masturbation, I presume.
No, of course not.
And it's, I mean, with masturbation, there is at least the memory of the person, or there's still the relationship with the fan, with the, help me out here.
Well, I would say, I'd say that's gone as well. I'd say masturbation pre the porn culture, you would build up your own fantasies and images and whatever made sense to you. Now, when you speak to men who masturbate, all they can pull up are the porn images, whether they've got porn in front of them or not. And in fact, it was very common in my interviews, and studies show this, that men, in order to ejaculate, even if they're with a real human being, a real woman, they have to pull up their porn in order to ejaculate their images.
Okay, I was talking to someone not long ago who is known for being an attractive woman. And this person said that she had boyfriends who broke up with her because of pornography. And that really hit me hard with the power of pornography, that they are with actually someone whom other men probably fantasize about, and they're actually with her. And she doesn't want them to use porn, and they still did. And their attraction to porn, and for God's sake, they may have actually been masturbating to porn images, like pornographed images of her. It's like, so the point is that they were choosing porn over this woman whom other men would fantasize about. And that,
yeah, but who would get tired of very quickly. You see, the great thing about porn, and that's why the average sort of shelf life of a woman in the porn industry is 3 months. When you go on most porn sites, they'll say fresh meat every week. Guys like to see new, different women. They want to see changes. I mean, a woman can't survive very long in the porn industry because they want to see something different. So even if she's, and by the way, I smiled when you used the word attractive because you're letting your age show, and we're probably similar age, actually. No one in my classes uses attractive. The word is hot, right? You've got to be hot because that means sexual. We used to say attractive. When somebody was good looking, I remember that was the word you used, was attractive. No, that's gone. I've never heard any of my students use that word. It's always hot. And of course, hot means sexual sizzle as well as looking good. But the interesting thing about the porn industry is this, they have to keep revolving through women. This is why I think they're going to move a lot more to Eastern Europe, where there's no end of poor women. Thanks to, you know, what global capitalism has done to Eastern Europe. And they want change. And I remember when I was writing Pornland, there was this a very popular site, and it promised first time ever on porn. And I was looking at the sites where guys discuss porn, because, you know, there's all these sites where guys go on and discuss their favorite porn scenes, or they'll ask questions like, can someone tell me the best scene where the bitch really hates it, or where the bitch starts to cry? These are the kinds of questions they ask, and you get hundreds of answers. You know, go to film A at 3 minutes, 14 seconds, and you'll see where she really can't stand it anymore. So I was on these sites, and one of the longest threads was on about this site that said she was new to porn. This is the first time ever on porn she's ever been seen. And in fact, it was somebody'd recognized from another porn film. Well, they were enraged because they had been promised new meat, fresh meat. And what it turned out was she was not fresh meat. Why? Because she was, quote, a whore, and she'd been in porn before. And it was so interesting. I got my head around, why are they so upset that this is not the first time? What I realized is what was exciting was to watch her go from being a civilian to a porn whore. They wanted to be present at the moment of that change.
Well, and I think that that gets to the absolute heart of patriarchy. And I mean, it seems to me that the central imperative of patriarchy is the violation imperative, to take someone and to show your own superiority to them. And how do you show your superiority? By violating them. And that violation imperative is insatiable because there are always new.
Perfect.
Always new people, including non-human people, including the land, including the moon. That's why they bombed the moon.
Yeah. There's never enough. The truth is there's never enough, though. As many as there's new, it's never enough. How many more porn images do we really need? How much more destruction to the environment do you need? It's never enough. It's insatiable.
And there's this wonderful line by R.D. Lang, who was an abusive jerk, but yeah, also wrote great stuff. Have you plug a void plugging a void? And that's part of the problem, I think, is that pornography is using a void to plug a void. And as such, so I guess we've got like 5 or 10 minutes left, and there's a couple questions I want to ask. One of them is, can you hit again just the whole notion of the spectacle and of this void plugging a void? And you've hit this pretty hard, but can you talk again about how, because there is no emotional connection to it, it becomes boring and always must accelerate? How the spectacle always has to accelerate.
That's right. Well, first of all, I would say avoid plugging a void is, remember, in many cases, the pornographers create the void in the first place. So you have the void created by the porn, then plugging a void created by the porn, and on and on and on. Because I think all of us have a desire for connection and intimacy. And I think pornography comes in and strips young boys of that desire. And because when you think about what makes sex interesting with another human being, it's the idiosyncrasies of the other person. It's the way they move their mouth. It's the way they joke. Just think of all what makes intimacy interesting, and not just sex, but intimacy. Now take porn. Porn is generic. It's formulaic. Right, I can literally map out your average porn scene that you will come across now. So if you're going to bleed out all that makes sex and intimacy interesting, you're going to have to fill it in, the void, with something. And what you fill that void in with is anger and rage and hate and everything else. I say in my book, porn is about making hate to women, not making love. Everything you think about when you make love, all those emotions you think about of connection and intimacy and kindness and warmth, all of that is destroyed. And in its place is hate and loathing and debasement and dehumanization. And so the best sex you have is when you have connection. The best porn you have is when you have utter disconnection, when you can take that bitch, horse, slut, whatever you want to call her, and totally, as they say in the porn world, drill her till there's nothing left. I mean, when you watch porn, I mean, so I have to say, when I was watching porn for my book, there was times when I would literally dissociate from the violence. And luckily, I don't have a history of sexual violence, because I don't know if I could do this work if I did, to be perfectly honest with you. I think I would dissociate too much if I did. But even me, I would literally dissociate. I can remember times of seeing violence where I literally didn't know what to do with myself. I was almost weeping on the floor. There was one scene when I started to write the book where you've got a guy with a woman's head down a toilet and he's penetrating her from behind, and people should just know there's a sort of trigger alert here. And he's got her head in the toilet, he's flushing it, and he's screaming at her, "I'm going to fuck you till your motherfucker comes up from the fucking grave." And this went on for, I clocked it. It was 30 seconds and it felt like 30 hours in my body. And I literally turned off the computer. I couldn't do anything. I literally just was just rendered. I was like paralyzed. That level of hatred. How is it possible, A, that men make it, and B, men find it arousing? And that was the teaser on one of the top visited porn sites. So, you know, I often say to people, I have studied porn for 25 years. I probably know more about the industry and porn than most living people, and that includes the pornographers. And yet, in a profound way, I don't understand it. I don't get anything. I really can't understand it. I can't understand that level of hatred that can then be linked with arousal. There's a way in which I really don't get it.
I have to tell you that I say that same thing about environmental destruction every single day. You know, I've written 20 some books. I don't get it. I don't understand any of it. And so I guess two questions. One of them you've made very clear so far, but I want to ask this question just because I love your answer so much. And that is, one of the arguments that is made against you is that because you're against pornography, obviously you must not like sex and you must be just this prude. So do you want to respond to that one?
I'd love to respond to that. I always say if I was going around the country talking about the impact of the fast food industry and the way that McDonald's lays waste to the environment, nobody would accuse me of being anti-eating. They would see that I'm against the industry as opposed to the human act and enjoyment of eating. To say that I am against sex when I'm against pornography is to conflate the porn industry with sex. And this, by the way, is part of the brilliance of the porn industry. They have said, if you're against porn, you're against sex. So what I argue is that porn is to sex what McDonald's is to food. It's the industrialization, formulaic, generic renditioning of what is a, you know, human creative act. And it is knocked out by the porn industry and turned into an industrial product.
And it is embarrassing to, I think, you and to me and to the entire culture that you even have to say that.
Well, it tells you something about the culture that they can't separate porn from sex. And I think it's true. There's, you know how many men say to me, and I mean, these are not said in a angry way after I've given a lecture at a university. They'll say, well, if I don't use porn, what am I going to masturbate to? And I'll say to them, you know what? Supposing I was coming in here again and talking about the fast food industry, you wouldn't say to me, if I can't eat a McDonald's, what should I eat? And I wouldn't tell you what to eat. You know what? I don't know what you want to eat. You might like French food, Italian. Who the hell knows what you want to eat? It's not up to me to tell you what to eat. So it's the same thing. I don't know what you like sexually. I don't know who you are. I don't know who you would grow into if you could develop your own sexuality without this porn industry round your neck. So you know what? If people who come in and talk about the food industry, they don't bring recipes with them and tell you this is what you should cook and how to cook it. Go ahead, experiment, have fun, enjoy it. Of course, with sex, it has to be consensual. But who am I to tell you what to do sexually, all I can say is that the porn industry shouldn't be the ones to tell you. You should be allowed to be the author of your own sexuality. That is, I think, a basic human right that the porn industry is robbing us of.
So I guess my last question, we're running out of time. My last question is, so if you were made the queen of all things associated with pornography, or the queen of the minister of cultural information.
Oh yeah, that's going to happen. Yeah, go
yeah,
on.
Yeah. So what would you can't take down capitalism. We're going to accept capitalism for now. You can take down capitalism next week.
But okay.
For now you have to keep capitalism in place. But you can do whatever you want with the porn industry. What sort of legislation would you put through? What sort of regulation or elimination, or what would you do if you were suddenly put in charge of dealing with porn?
Well, you see, if we've got capitalism, the reality is I wouldn't be able to do anything because it's, but let's just assuming I could for the time being.
Yes. And thank you for saying that. I love the fact you just said that.
Yeah. Thank you. I would have to say that I would go the way that Andrew Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon started, and which Iceland is thinking of, which is defining pornography as a violation of women's civil rights. And I would use, as Dworkin and MacKinnon so brilliantly thought of, the civil rights legislation as a way to think about what to do with porn. I mean, if we take the civil rights of women seriously, if we take equality seriously, then you cannot have a society where women are full and equal citizens and have this juggernaut called pornography breathing down the necks of men everywhere. So I would begin to develop a legislation that was based on civil rights law to figure out how to go after the pornographers and sue them, pornographer by pornographer.
So I guess the very, very last thing is, what do you want individuals to do, both women and men, having heard this interview, what do you want them to do?
I would like them to go to stoppornculture.org and join us. And because you know what? You can't do this, as we all know. Movements are not made up of individuals. The movement is always bigger than the collective of the individuals. And that's why we started Stop Porn Culture, because people feel overwhelmed by the porn culture. So what I would say is go to Stop Porn Culture, join up, come to our conferences, become part of our movement. Pornography is a global industry. The only way you stop global industries is through global movements. So that's what I'd have to say to people. If you're going to go at this as an individual level, you are going to burn out, you're going to feel helpless and hopeless, and you're not going to be any good to yourself or anybody else. This has to be movement based. And you know what? The old idea that feminists have no sense of humor. I don't know people funnier than feminists. We are the funniest people around. So we will be doing this, and we have a lot of fun as we're closing down this industry. So that would be my offer to people. Join us at Stop Porn Culture.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Gail Dines. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.